All right. Well, we've come to the end of the beginning. So let's open up to Genesis 50. Actually, we're going to pick up in verse 29 of 49. That's where we left off. We left off with Jacob having gathered his sons to himself there around his bed. And you remember he prophesied over each of them and pronounced blessings upon them. And then we read, then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. So here's Jacob. He's been in Egypt now for some 17 years. And now he's dying. But he doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. He wants to be buried in the promised land with Abraham and with Isaac. And as we're going to see, even as we go on and see the final words of Joseph tonight, that Joseph had that same desire to be back in the land. Now, one of the things that we didn't go into a whole lot of detail on as we've been studying through Genesis was the Abrahamic covenant in the sense that it relates to the possession of the land. And so even though we're going to finish tonight, we're not totally finishing because when I get back from the trip, there's a few loose ends I want to tie up. But I really want to look more closely at that aspect of the covenant and looking at that whole promise that God gave to them of that land. And we can see here with Jacob, we see this deep conviction that he is to be buried in this land. Now, remember, this is the land that God had promised to Abraham and to his seed. But at the present time, they only own this small little portion that Abraham and evidently Isaac and Jacob as well, all of them had purchased it from Ephron the Hittite. So this little field is all that they possess, but they have the promise of possession of the entire land. Now, of course, as we follow the history of Israel under Moses and then under Joshua, when they enter into the land, they will ultimately, to a large degree, they will inherit what God promised to them. But, you know, in actuality, they never did inherit all of it. And the full inheritance of the land is something that is actually yet in the future. You know, this is a thing to me that it's pretty astounding. And, you know, we talk about Israel a lot. And yet sometimes I wonder, you know, if we realize how Israel itself is such a great apologetic for the truth of the scriptures. You know, here we are today, some 6,000 years later, or 4,000 years later, from the time of Abraham anyway. And we see his descendants in the land that God promised to them, but still unable to fully possess it. We see all of the ongoing opposition to their possession of the land. And things will actually continue that way until the Lord gives them the land when he returns. But we'll look at that in some detail in a few weeks. But it is an interesting thing that here we see with Jacob, don't bury me in Egypt. I need to be in the promised land. Another thing that I find interesting here is he says, it's there that I buried Leah. Now remember the story. Jacob, of course, fell in love with Rachel. And he served Laban for Rachel. And then you remember Laban pulled the trick on him and slipped in Leah. So Jacob ended up first marrying Leah and then later being able to marry Rachel. But Rachel was, you know, in one sense, you know, she really was the love of his life. Joseph and Benjamin were her sons. They were his favored children. But it is interesting that when it comes to being buried, he doesn't say, bury me in Bethlehem with Rachel. He says, bury me in Machpelah with Leah. And I think the reason for that is that as much as he loved Rachel and as much as he loved Joseph and Benjamin, the covenant was really through Leah, because she was the mother of Judah. And as we saw, the promise, this messianic promise has passed from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Now it's passed on to Judah. And so Leah, the one who never really was loved or felt that love in the end, she sort of wins. And Jacob is to be buried with her. And so when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now, of course, embalming was a practice that was made famous among the Egyptians. And the embalming and the mummifying of their royalty. And, you know, you can go into many of the museums around the world today, and you can see these mummified kings and pharaohs. And it's amazing that, you know, 4,000 years later, they're still fairly intact. So the Egyptians developed quite a process there. So 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him for 70 days. Now, if a pharaoh died, there was a 72-day mourning for the pharaoh among the people. Jacob is mourned for 70 days among the Egyptians. So that'll give you some kind of an idea of the esteem in which Jacob was held among the Egyptians. So, you know, we don't really have any information about Jacob's activity in Egypt, but he was there for 17 years. He was the father of Joseph, and of course Joseph was greatly loved by the Egyptian people. But by this 70-day mourning, that seems to indicate that Jacob was held in very high esteem among the Egyptians. Now, when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. Then they came to the threshing floor of Atad. So Atad is evidently a man that was known at that time. We don't know anything about him, but that's where they came to, which is beyond the Jordan. And they mourned there with great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a deep mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So Abel Mizraim means, it means either the mourning of the Egyptians or possibly the meadow of the Egyptians. But it's interesting, the Canaanites, their assumption was this was just, you know, strictly an Egyptian affair, when in actuality, it was the burial of Jacob. But this massive gathering from Egypt that came into the land. And so his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. So these guys, now remember, 17 years have passed since they were reunited with Joseph, reconciled to him, but they're still a bit fearful that retribution could fall. And I don't think that Joseph ever would have given them any reason to feel that way. I think it was just their own consciences. They just knew that what they had done to Joseph was so dastardly. They just almost, you know, expected something's got to happen. We've got to have some judgment fall on us. And so maybe now that our father has passed away, maybe Joseph was just, you know, for the sake of our father, maybe he was being gracious to us. But perhaps now that our father has passed away, Joseph is going to repay us and notice for all the evil which we did to him. They're acknowledging their evil. And so they sent messengers to Joseph saying, before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now, some commentators feel that Jacob didn't necessarily tell them to do this. This was their own way of trying to sort of soften things, you know. Of course, Joseph had such a tender heart for his dad. So, you know, let's tell him that this is what our father told us to say. Now, that's speculation on the part of, like I said, some commentators. I don't know that we need to go that far with the speculation. Jacob very well might have said that. Actually, I could see Jacob saying that. Quite often, he probably looked at them and thought, oh, you guys deserve to be punished for what you did. You better go to Joseph. You better really repent. You better really tell him how sorry you are. I could see Jacob perhaps doing that. So That's what they said. This is what our father said. So now please forgive the trespass of your servants or of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. You know, as we pointed out before, Joseph was just a prince among men, you know. And he's weeping, I think, really, probably because he just can't believe that these guys think that he would actually pay them back at this point. Not that he's weeping like, you know, his feelings are hurt or anything, but I think he's just, it seems that there's just compassion for them. Oh, you poor guys, you know, that's not even in my heart to do anything like that. And so Joseph wept when he spoke to them. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." And Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. You know, it's interesting. Each sentence in Joseph's reply really shows the kind of faith that he had. Joseph had the kind of faith where he was content to leave all righting of wrongs to God. And that's what he's implying when he says to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" It's not, in other words, he's saying, it's not my place to take vengeance upon you. That's not my place. And in that, we see a man who was content to just leave it in God's hands. And remember, as we looked at the prophecies and the blessings that Jacob pronounced on his sons in the previous chapter, you remember what he said about Joseph, how he talked about he had been hated and the archers had shot at him and they had bitterly grieved him. But remember what he said, but his bow remained in strength. And we saw that that's really a reference to the fact that Joseph didn't retaliate. He didn't take vengeance upon them. You know, it takes real trust in God when somebody has wronged us to let it go and to just leave it in God's hands. And there might even come occasions like Joseph was faced with here, where there was an opportunity for vengeance. And, you know, just from the mere human standpoint, there was complete justification. If Joseph would have at this point brought down some kind of a judgment upon his brothers, who could blame him? They themselves couldn't even blame him. So here the opportunity for vengeance has presented itself, but Joseph is a man who has such confidence in the Lord that he's content to leave it with God. Who am I? Am I in the place of God? If God hasn't brought a judgment on you, then how would it be that I could think that I could do such a thing? And so we see the great faith of Joseph there, in that he was willing to leave that all in God's hands. We see also, secondly, that Joseph is able to see through the malice of these men. He's able to see the providence of God. "But as for you, you meant evil against me." You know, he doesn't lessen the blow. He doesn't say, "Well, you know, you guys didn't really mean that. You know, you didn't know what you were doing. You know, of course, Under other circumstances, it probably never would have happened. He says, no, you meant evil against me. Their intent was evil. But again, Joseph is able to look beyond them, and he's able to look beyond the human circumstances, and he's able to say, but God meant it for good. God meant it for good. And again, as we go through life, there will be things that people and Satan will bring our way, and the intention is evil. The intention is to harm us. The intention is to hurt us. Some cases destroy us. But God is bigger than all of that. And God is able to turn those things around. And this particular verse here, the corresponding verse in the New Testament is really, as we pointed out before, the corresponding verse is Romans 8:28. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. And you see, Joseph, as I've pointed out, Joseph's life is a great illustration of Romans 8:28. And here in this particular 20th verse, he kind of sums it all up right there. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And what a great and wonderful thing to know that God is able to take even the evil intent of men and to turn it around and to use those things that people intend for evil toward us, to use those things for good in our lives. Now, we've got to keep in mind, there were lots of years when that was not really, you know, clear in Joseph's understanding. This, of course, you know, is coming with hindsight. He's seen the fulfillment of the promises. He's seen the blessing of God. There were those years when there would have been uncertainty. There would have been confusion. There would have been doubts. There would have been questions about just, you know, what is really going on here. But as I've mentioned before, Joseph had those promises of God that he hung on to those. And you see, like we've said many times, when God gives a promise, it's something we've got to hang on to. Because if God gives you a promise, this is what you can absolutely bet on. You can stake your life on it. If God gives you a promise, he is going to fulfill it. You might say, well, he hasn't fulfilled it yet. Well, evidently the time for fulfillment hasn't come yet. Oh, but to you, it seems like it should have come a long time ago. You see, this is the dilemma that we find ourselves in. Because it does seem to us from our point of view that, you know, Lord, what is taking so long? Lord, you know, you told me that you were going to do these things. And what's happened to all of that? But you see, if God has given a promise, you can bet your life he is going to fulfill that promise. And if he hasn't fulfilled it yet, what are you supposed to do? You just keep waiting. And you just keep faithful and you just keep believing. I just believe that God's going to do it. And you know, like we pointed out back when, you know, that day when Joseph woke up in prison and by the afternoon he was in the palace. You know, one day when you least expect it. Maybe one day when you've kind of just, you know, even forgotten about it. Suddenly it's all there. God brings it all together. You know, you think of Zechariah, the husband of Elizabeth. Remember when the angel Gabriel appeared to him and basically told him, you know, your prayer has been answered. You're going to have a son. Now, evidently, this was a prayer that he hadn't prayed for quite a while. He'd probably, to some extent, given up on ever having an answer to that prayer. But when he least expected it, there it was. See, God is faithful. And even though not only do we have times of delay, but we have times where there's an attempt, or in some cases a concerted effort on the part of the enemy to overthrow the plan of God, to prevent the plan of God from happening, it's not possible. God's going to get his plan accomplished. And even though there might be evil intent, God is able to turn all of those things around. The third thing we see with Joseph here, not only was he able to leave it to God to right the wrongs, not only could he see God's providence even in the midst of man's malice, but we see with Joseph that he repaid evil not only with forgiveness, but with practical affection. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. Not only did Joseph completely forgive them, but he blessed them. He did good to them. And even though Joseph, of course, he's an Old Testament saint. He's centuries away from the new covenant. He's centuries away from, the Spirit of God coming in and making him a new man. And he's centuries away from that, what we would know today as the fruit of the Spirit operating in our lives. He's manifesting all of the characteristics of just a true believer in his confidence in the Lord and his willingness to leave it in God's hands. And then he's going to forgive them and he's going to bless them. Now with Joseph, as we've mentioned, touched on here and there, there are so many ways in which Joseph really seems to be a type of Christ. It's never stated anywhere that he is a type of Christ. As a matter of fact, there are many places where there's obviously a picture being painted of Christ, and it's never clearly stated that that's the case. Remember when we studied the offering up of Isaac on Mount Moriah? And clearly that is a prophecy of the Father and the Son and the love and the offering and all of those things. It's, it doesn't say somewhere at the end of that story, oh, by the way, this is a prophecy about Jesus who will come in the future. But as we look at the story, we see the parallels are so clear. And so likewise with Joseph, as we look at the life of Joseph, there's so many things where he is paralleling in his own experiences and in his own behavior and his attitude, especially toward his brothers, he's paralleling Christ. And one of the things, of course, that we read in the prophets in the future about when the Lord returns and is finally recognized by his people, the Jews, who have all of these long centuries rejected him, one of the things that's spoken of in those prophetic scriptures is the abundance of grace and love that God is going to pour out upon them in those days. And that passage there, I think we referred to it a while back, but that passage in Zechariah, that in that day there shall be a fountain open in Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. And there's going to be this abundance of grace. And just as Joseph is here, really not only forgiving, but lavishing his love and comfort and provision upon these who betrayed him, that's a beautiful picture of Jesus and what he will do for his people when they do finally embrace him. And so he comforted them and he spoke kindly to them. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. So remember, Joseph went to Egypt when he was 17. So he spent the vast majority of his life in Egypt. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. Now, the book of Genesis, like the Old Testament in microcosm, it ends by pointing beyond its own story. And as I said tonight, we've come to the end of the beginning. So it's the end of the beginning. It's not the end of the story. It's the end of the beginning of the story. The story that began in the garden. But the story that will go on and on and on for many, many centuries. Of course, you know, finally coming to a culmination in the coming of Christ. But then the story continuing on even to this very day. And not being complete until the Lord actually returns. So it ends by pointing beyond. Joseph says, I'm going to die, but God is going to visit you. As we look at the story from this point, man has traveled far from life and fellowship with God in Eden, finally to what we read here in the final words, a coffin in Egypt. I mean, think of the contrast of that. You know, when you contrast the very last words of Genesis with the very first words of Genesis, it's astounding. In the beginning, God created. The whole first portion of Genesis is, it's all about life. It's biogenesis. It's the beginning of all life. And the whole of the first couple of chapters, as you know, is just, it's just teeming with life. But the final words are words of death. In the beginning, God created. And everything was good. And now we come all the way to a coffin in Egypt. But, as I'm saying, the story doesn't end there. For Joseph's last words were a declaration of his faith in the promises of God. God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. I love that. Joseph doesn't insist on being buried in Canaan like Jacob was. And, you know, again, Joseph, to me, he's so amazing because, you know, he's a man of such deep spiritual insight. Joseph, he clearly believes in the promises of God. He clearly believes in the promises of God. So he knows also that God had declared to Abraham that his descendants, Joseph being one of them, his descendants would be strangers in a strange land for 400 years. And so Joseph makes no attempt to have them move his body to Canaan once he dies. He says, I'm going to die. God's going to visit you. And when you leave this place, take my bones with you. Something about that is powerful to me. It's just the absolute confidence that Joseph had in the promises of God. And again, these are, you know, these men are, they're examples to us. They're examples to us that we would likewise have that kind of confidence. What God has said, I believe it. I'm going to stand on it. I have every bit of trust that the Lord is going to do what he said he's going to do. But you know, it's in these days that we're living in, for some reason, you know, it seems that so many people, when darkness comes or when things get really difficult, instead of just, you know, standing firm on those promises, a lot of times people are just letting go of the whole thing. We received a kind of a funny call the other day on the radio. The person was calling in to talk about how they were losing their faith because of what the government was doing and, you know, cutting back their benefits. You know, he thought, well, hey, look, don't lose your faith in God because Sacramento's letting you down. I mean, you know, let's understand these are two completely different things. But it's true so often that, you know, I mean, these are really times of testing, but this is the time to believe what God said. You see, that's the whole point. You know, when I'm not in a time of distress, do I really think all that much about the promises of God? Not necessarily. I'm just kind of cruising. Everything's going well. I don't have many difficulties. I'm praising God and I'm thankful. But, you know, but it's when things get tough and things get tight and I get in, you know, some kind of a situation where there's pressure. What do I do then? Well, it's not time to let go of the promises. It's time to lay hold of them. And by faith to say, yes, God, you know, I'm taking you at your word. I'm believing you. I'm trusting you. And listen, tonight, if you have been, you know, at some point in time, if God has spoken to you some promise in his word, and now you find yourself in difficulty, you find yourself in distress, I want you to know that that word that he spoke to you back then was a word for you to hold on to right now. Hold on to that word. Believe it. Lay hold of it. Stand on it. And trust God is going to do what he said he's going to do. You know, we get to a place sometimes where we say, well, okay, but I think God told me that before, but I need him to tell me something else. I need a fresh, you know, revelation. I need a fresh word. Now, I felt like that before. But, you know, in my own experience, there are times when I kind of feel like the Lord's saying to me, you've got enough. You've got all I'm going to give you. So you just keep holding on to what I've said to you before. A couple of years ago, I was, I've got this really thick book called Old Testament History, written by a guy named Alfred Edersheim. And Alfred Edersheim was a scholar. He was Jewish, who, you know, came to faith in Christ and became a great theologian in the church. He was also a great rabbinical theologian as well. But anyway, he wrote this book, The History of the Old Testament. And a few years ago, I just felt sort of led to read it. And I want to read you a couple of paragraphs from the final pages on Genesis to kind of enforce what I'm saying right here. Here's what Edersheim said. He said, Joseph was full of honors in Egypt, yet his last act was to disown Egypt and to choose the lot of Israel. Poverty, contempt, and pilgrimage. To renounce the present in order to cleave to the future. His last deed was to take a solid oath of the children of Israel to carry up his bones with them into the land of promise. In obedience to his wishes, they embalmed his body and laid it in one of those Egyptian coffins, generally made of sycamore wood, which resembled the shape of the human body. Now listen. And there, through the ages of suffering and bondage, stood the figure-like coffin of Joseph, ready to be lifted and carried thence when the sure hour of deliverance had come. Thus Joseph, being dead, yet spoke to Israel, telling them that they were only temporary sojourners in Egypt, and that their eyes must be turned away from Egypt toward the land of promise, and that in patience of faith they must wait for the hour when God would certainly and graciously fulfill his own promise. When at the close of this first period of covenant history we look around, we feel as if now indeed the horrors of great darkness were fast falling upon Israel, which Abraham had experienced as he was shown the future of his descendants. Already personal intercourse between heaven and earth had ceased. From the time that Jacob had paid his vow in Bethel, no personal manifestation of God, such as had often gladdened his fathers and him, was any more vouchsafed, except on his entrance into Egypt and then for a special purpose. And now long centuries of utter silence were to follow. During all that weary period with misery of their bondage and the temptation of idolatry around constantly increasing, there was neither voice from heaven nor visible manifestation to warn or to cheer the children of Israel in Egypt. One mode of guidance was for a time withdrawn. Here's the final word. Israel had now only the past to sustain and direct them. But the past with its history and its promises was sufficient. God expects us to stand and depend on what he's told us. He expects us to believe that it's true and to conduct ourselves in conformity to those truths. And you see, like I'm saying, you know, sometimes we're in a position where we're crying out, well, Lord, I need more. I need you to give me another sign. I need you to tell me again. I need you to, you know, show me a new thing. And the Lord would say, no. The past history and the promises are sufficient. You stand on what I told you. You believe what I told you. You lay hold of what I told you. And you see, that's where the rest comes. That's where the peace comes. And that's what Israel had now as they're going into this season. Now, the final words here, we read, so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Now, if we flip over the page to Exodus, it's a continuation of the story, but there's some 350 years at least that have elapsed between the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus. So they're entering into this long, dark period, but God intends for them to be sustained by reflecting on their past history and on the promises of the future. When we go into times of darkness, and what I mean by times of darkness, I'm not talking about times of sin. I'm talking about times of darkness where we don't understand, where we don't see the fulfillment of the promises, where it doesn't really look like the way we imagined it was going to look. It's not working out the way we thought it was going to work out. See, it's during those times that we've got to reflect back on the history and think of all of those great things that God did. And that's what Israel had. They had that great history. They could go all the way back and see the hand of God from the very beginning of time moving toward the fulfillment of his promises. And they had that past history with all of its promises of future blessing. And that was the very thing that God gave them to go into Egypt with. And that's it. Sometimes we go into seasons of confusion. We go into seasons of drought. We go into seasons of darkness. And we go in with the past and the promises of the future. And that's what we've got to hold on to. We've got to look back and remember the goodness of the Lord. We've got to remember all that God did. We've got to remember all those things that He's told us and how He's worked and how He's come through. And then we've got to go back and take those promises that He's given and say, okay, Lord, I'm going to believe You. You know, one of my favorite passages is Isaiah chapter 50, verse 10. And I would invite you to turn there with me. It's an interesting, it's a really interesting passage, because it tells you something that you sometimes don't even think is a possibility. I know as a young Christian, I remember as a young Christian, I never imagined that as a Christian, I could go through deep, dark valleys. I never imagined as a Christian that I could go through seasons of dryness and times of just confusion. I just never even thought that was a possibility. As a young Christian, I just thought, well, you know, the Christian life is just about joy and excitement and just skipping from one thing to another and just having, you know, one victory after another. That was my preconceived idea of the Christian life. But it wasn't too far down the road that I found out that it can sometimes be quite a bit different. And this passage, Isaiah 50:10, became a lifesaver for me. Look at what it says. Who among you fears the Lord, who obeys the voice of His servant, who walks in darkness and has no light? How? You think, what? Wait a second. How could that be possible? Fearing the Lord, obeying the voice of His servant, but walking in darkness and not having light? You see, again, to the immature Christian mind, that seems like an impossibility. If you're walking in darkness and don't have light, it must be because you really don't fear God and you're not obeying the voice of His servant. That's how we would think. But listen, there are times when it's not because you don't fear the Lord. It's not because you've been disobedient. None of those things are really the issue. It is simply that God has allowed, for purposes that we just can't figure out, God has allowed us to enter into times of darkness. We walk in darkness. We have no light. But listen to what it says. Let him trust in the name of the Lord and let him rely upon his God. And the word rely here means let him lean with all of his weight on his God. I love that. What do you do in times of darkness when you have no light? Here's what you do not do. You do not back away from the Lord. You do not throw aside those promises and say, oh, well, you know, that's never going to happen. God's let me down. You don't do that. This is what you do. You press into God. That's what we're being told here. You trust in the name of the Lord and you rely. You lean heavily. You put all your weight on the Lord. And you know what? He's going to sustain you. He's going to hold you up. He's not going to let you fall. Hold on to those promises of God. And even though you might think you need more, no, you don't. That's enough. God's given you enough. I've come at times in my life to places where, you know, it's sort of like the, I don't know, revelation's probably not the right word, but just, you know, that kind of encouragement or all of that I'm really longing for, it's just sort of cut off. And I'll be saying, Lord, come on, I just need another. Oh, Lord, just send me one more little arrow message. But nothing comes. But then that little subtle, you know, that still small voice will just say, you've got enough. Hang on to what you've got. And so, like Israel, they had the past and they had the promises of the future. And although Joseph was put in a coffin in Egypt, it was only the end of the beginning. And there were great things that God had in store for them as a nation. As you know, he would, of course, ultimately, with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, he would deliver them from that bondage. And so with us, in his appointed time, with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm, just like he reached down to that prison and pulled Joseph out just in a split second, God's going to do that. I know for a fact that there are people in here tonight that feel like, you know, you've just come to the end. I know there are people that, you know, somebody even told me this evening, I just want to go be with the Lord. Everything here is ruined. It's all a disaster. But remember this, it's not over yet. There's another part to the story. And you can imagine, as we've talked about Joseph, he was completely human. He wasn't some super saint kind of a guy in the sense that he never was discouraged or doubtful or any of that. You know, there were times when he was in that prison when he probably just thought, you know, this is it. I'm never getting out of this place. I'm never going to get back to Canaan. I'm never going to see my family again. But he didn't despair. He did hold on. And as he would, I would just imagine, as he would have those doubts and those things that would flood his mind, I'm sure at times he would go, but, you know, I just can't shake those dreams, though. You know, just that's, there's something to that. And I know for myself, when, you know, doubt comes in and seems to cloud everything, there's that little seed of, but you know, the Lord, I just remember when the Lord spoke that, and I know that was God. So, okay, Lord, I'm holding on to that little grain of your word, and I'm trusting. So, we can do that because these guys did it. And God wrote it all down to give us examples of how men and women in days of old lived and walked and prospered by faith. And he's calling us to follow in their steps. And so may we take to heart these lessons from the lives of these great men, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And may we follow in their footsteps of faith.